ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This conversation includes content that may be sensitive for some listeners. Please take care when listening.
In the 1970s and 80s, there used to be this kind of urban counterculture in Australia that clustered around the inner city suburbs of our major cities, a culture that's almost completely gone now. Back then in suburbs like New Farm and Darlinghurst and Fitzroy and Kent Town, it was possible for artists and musicians and writers to live in rundown terrace houses and squats using the dole as a kind of arts subsidy. People lived hand-to-mouth existences in those places, and there was an alarming amount of hard drugs floating around. But for all that, these places were exciting and supportive and creatively vibrant. So much so that richer people eventually moved into those suburbs, renovated the squats, and then told the pubs to keep the noise down. Michael Kelly is here today. Michael is an artist who has sketched the people and places of that lost bohemian world and all the other things he sees in the world. Over the years, Michael's lived in family squats. He's lived in a decommissioned mental asylum and in a van, sketching and drawing and painting, regardless of whether he had a proper roof over his head or a secure income. He kept drawing. And at times, Michael was troubled by the memory of a sister he had, a sister who had disappeared from view when he was a small child, and these memories eventually led him to search for her again. Throughout the decades, as an artist, Michael kept meticulous sketchbooks as a way to keep track of his world, of his dreams, his ideas, of people and places. He worried for a long time these sketchbooks might just end up in a dumpster. But now 65 of Michael's sketchbooks have been acquired by the State Library of New South Wales. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Richard.
Were you often scribbling away at things as a kid?
Yes, I was. I was always doodling in the back of exercise books when I should have been working out mathematics problems or whatever. So, I was always sort of in my own little world, some dream world, doodling away and sketching, but not so much what was around me, but what was whatever was on my mind at the time.
I used to sketch all the time when I was little. And it was a way not only of just occupying myself, but to, I don't know, people to keep away, well, wouldn't bother you so much, you wouldn't get bullied so much if you could draw interesting things. Did you find that?
I did get bullied a bit, but I tended to sort of withdraw and people just used to leave me alone, largely. So I didn't, I sort of flew under the radar, largely.
Was it a refuge from other people in some ways?
Probably, yes, it was, because, social interactions were always very difficult and school was difficult and I'd spent a lot of lunchtimes in the library just because I found it so awkward being around other kids, so to speak.
Your dad was an ABC broadcaster.
That's right. He was a newsreader in the 60s and 70s, and he worked in the ABC all that time.
What kind of a man was he, in your memory?
He was very kind of remote and distant. He worked shift work. He married my mum when they were both very young. They were both from single parent families. Neither of them knew their father, so neither of them had brothers and sisters. He was they met in Brisbane, and he used to drink a lot then. Then he stopped drinking shortly after I was born, and he got his act together and he got a job with the ABC in Orange. So my parents moved down to Orange where I was born. But I remember my father usually with his head in a book with newspapers everywhere. And he was a very serious fellow, actually. And he read a lot and still does. And we've renewed our relationship just in the last few years. He's lived in Ireland for many years with his second wife. He's still a well-spoken, polite, serious, well-read man. Informed, yeah, very much so.
How about your mum? How different was she?
My mum was very different, although in her personality she was similar in that she was fairly serious and closed into herself, and she kept things to herself largely, but she was a wonderful mother, and she'd been a dressmaker by trade. She'd grown up not knowing her father. She was brought up in Brisbane with her mother.
You're a quiet kid.
And yeah.
How concerned were your parents about your quietness?
Well, actually, my grandmother was very concerned about me. She was more concerned about me, I think, than my parents. And
your parents don't normally complain if the kid's quiet, do they?
No. And she dragged me off to this doctor somewhere in Brisbane. And I was about 3 years old and I'd never said anything. And the doctor said to my grandmother, he said, maybe he doesn't have anything to say yet. That was a good answer.
Yeah. Well, you're doing it in your art. Was it your grandmother who encouraged you in your art?
She did, yeah. My father's mother. Well, both my grandmothers, really. But my father's mother, when we moved down to Sydney, she was very encouraging like that. She actually helped me. Put me onto this job in way back in the early 70s in a place called Roosalt's up in Oxford Street. They used to do, or a commercial art studio, and I worked there for a little while, and I did a lot of different jobs in those days, but that was my first taste of, well, my first smell of terps and paint and all that sort of stuff.
You were the oldest child in your family, and then your first sister was born. Who had a disability. What was the nature of her disabilities when she was born?
Well, we never really knew. Back in those days, you know, the name changes all the time. Back in those days, they called her subnormal, which is not very nice in hindsight, but probably these days she'd be called intellectually disabled. But there was very little that was spoken about.
How did your parents cope with looking after her?
They, with great difficulty, I think, especially my mother, because later in life my mother would say how she cried a lot and she was always distressed. So they didn't cope very well at all. They didn't have any kind of wider family, really, or any, you know, many people who really understood what was happening.
So where was she taken to live eventually?
Into a big hospital near where we lived in the northern suburbs of Brisbane. It was a former TB hospital. You know, I was very young, so I didn't really understand what was happening. But there were people on the periphery who seemed to be around, and I think they gradually suggested that's the done thing.
How old was she, do you remember, about that time?
She was probably only about 3 or 4. She was really only a toddler, maybe not even that old. And I have memories. I was probably only, you know, 5 or 6 myself at the time of going to see her in this enormous big old institution, and my mum being distressed when we had to leave, and her being distressed. They're very powerful memories, and I still remember them very well. Yeah.
What were you told about her removal?
I don't think we were told anything much.
This is the 50s.
This is probably the late 50s, very early 60s.
Did the family talk about her at all after she moved into this hospital?
No, not much. We didn't talk. We never talked much about it at all. A couple of years after that, the family moved down to Sydney. We only were told that eventually Anne Louise moved down to another big hospital down here in Sydney, big institution, and that was pretty much it. It was something even later in life, as I reached my teens, and my other sister reached her teens. It was a taboo subject to mention, and I think because both my parents felt so much guilt about it that it was too painful for them to even go there. But my mother used to send parcels each Christmas and for a birthday, and occasionally the hospital would send photos. So that was about it.
The family, when you moved to Sydney, moved into a house in Lane Cove.
That's right, yeah.
What do you remember of that family home?
It was, you know, there were a lot of problems between my parents. There was a lot of unhappiness in the home. But it was, you know, an old sort of 30s, 40s brick house in Lane Cove, opposite a gully, opposite this bush beside us. And we lived there from probably about 64 till about early 1970. That's when we moved out.
This was a strange house. It was a particularly strange night, you remember. Tell me about that night.
Yes, well, my father worked shift work, and he would come home sometimes late of a night, and he'd go out onto the veranda and smoke a cigar or his pipe, whatever it was, and the balcony looked across to this gully across the road. There was one night there, I remember, and it was about June 69, my parents had been out to the movies, I think, and they came home and we were asleep, and there was this huge kerfuffle in the about 1 o'clock in the morning or something, and my father had come out, and my mother, and they thought that somebody was in the house because my father had been out on the balcony having a cigar or whatever, and he could hear this heavy breathing.
Heavy breathing?
Heavy breathing, yeah, like coming from down below, from the street below, which was very quiet.
What do you mean, like heavy breathing, like a kind of rasping?
Someone, that kind of strained breathing, I suppose. And I understood it because I was an asthmatic, and they'd gone to bed, and my father and my mother could hear it at the end of the bed. This same heavy breathing. It seemed to be coming closer and closer.
What did they do when they heard it at the end of the bed?
They sprung up and looked at each other and said, "What was that?" and jumped up and turned the lights on, by which time it had stopped, and then came running through the house, waking everybody up to see if there was someone in the house, and there wasn't. And then the next morning, my mum and dad mentioned it to our neighbours, and our neighbour's father was a funeral director, and he'd actually done the funeral of this young boy 12 months before, and I think my mum actually mentioned it to our neighbour, and she checked up. She said, "That sounds like it was around about the same time as that kid was found in the gully across the road." Anyway, 12 months before, this young boy had been in the gully in the bush where we all played as kids one day with two friends, and he had an asthma attack, and his friends panicked and went home and left him there and didn't say anything to anyone. And that night it was a cold, wet, wintry Sydney night at that time, and the following day, it was during school holiday, so it was around this time of year. The following day, there was ambulances and police, and they brought this kid out of the gully, and they later found out that, you know, he died from exposure with this asthma attack. And where they found his body, he would have been facing our house, looking towards it, and the chances, I think my father checked up, he was working night shift that day, so he would have come home late with the bedroom light on and been out on the balcony smoking his pipe, and that light would have shone straight across to the gully.
What do you make of all that, anyway? I mean, I've had interesting things happen to me in my life, and my attitude is to look at that line from Hamlet, "There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio." That's all I can sort of glint with that sort of stuff.
Exactly, very much so. I was only 14 years of age then, and being an asthmatic myself, I somehow was connected with it and sort of related to this sort of kid at a similar age to myself.
Were you frightened by it, or did it strike you compassion?
When I think of it now, I think of the atmosphere of the time, of the place, of sort of, you know, wintry, sort of dark. It was a kind of sad atmosphere, and the whole house was actually that whole time. So it seemed to manifest itself like that.
You mentioned your parents weren't happy together. What was the core of their unhappiness together, do you think?
A lot of it went to my sister. That had a huge impact on it. And probably my father, who I only learned it when my mother died, actually. I found their wedding, their marriage certificate, and I realised that my parents had got married when my mother was pregnant with me a few months. So I thought, that's why my father always had this resentment. He was, you know, he was probably never cut out for being a family person. And
was he more ambitious? Did he want to be out in the world?
Very much so, because he met my mother, you know, when he was drinking, and he was sort of lost. And then he stopped drinking, he sobered up, and he suddenly had this ambition. And he worked in the ABC, and I remember, you know, when we were kids, he had this opportunity to go and work in the United Nations, actually, in New York, you know. And he was pushing my mum to, you know, do that for a year or something. And my mum would say, "Fancy your father wanting to drag us off to New York." You know? And I thought, wow.
What?
What a place to grow, you know, being the teens growing up and going to school in the United Nations. But that's how different they were, and that's really, really, you know, they were two very different people.
So when you left home in the 1970s, what were you like in those first years of living out of home?
I was pretty hopeless. I was as hopeless as my father would have been, actually. I had no goals or ambitions. I, I, I,
Oh, you didn't tell yourself I've got to be an artist at that stage?
No, no, no.
Did you think you could be?
I didn't even know what an artist was. My brother and I got kicked out of school, actually, two schools in a short period of 6 months or so, and it was like, well, off to the workforce you go. And back in those days, you just walk in, you know, there were lots of jobs, and I found a job in the city as in an office, and I worked there for 18 months, and it was the longest job I had. Then I just sort of drifted through all these different jobs for the next 10 years, really, till my early 20s. And similar to my father, I stopped drinking and got myself together, and by this time my son had been born, and it was only later, really, that I had the opportunity to go to art school.
So you had a son, and he was born prematurely. What did that mean for him?
He was 3 months premie, and his mother and I spent a lot of time in the hospital. He later had problems. He had hydrocephalus. His mother spotted it, and he had to go into the children's hospital. He had a lot of operations. So we became used to spending a lot of time in hospitals, and I actually got a job in the hospital where he was born in, because I was there so often.
You and your partner split up while your son was still a baby, and eventually he came to live with you as a little kid. What were your living circumstances like then?
Not very good. I was living in Chippendale, actually. I was living in a boarding house in Chippendale. It was up in the Redfern end, on the corner of Abercrombie and Cleveland Street. The terrace house is still there, actually, and it was on the upper floor of this old terrace house, and there were elderly sort of people who used to drink a lot downstairs and out the back, and they were always fighting all night, and there was a house across the road that had a big sign around it saying, "Prepare to meet thy God." and that was the headquarters of the Church of the Open Skies, apparently.
Right.
I found out.
So, and there was also the big breweries around there in those days, too.
The big brewery down here. And you could smell it every morning. It was a wonderful smell. Even though I'd stopped drinking by then, it was a great smell.
So how did you find your way to a more communal way of living and raising kids?
I thought this is not a very good place for a, you know, 2-3 year old child to be growing up, and I found this it was a communal kids co-op over in Glebe, and I started taking my son to there, and I got involved there and met people, and some of those people lived in squats in Newtown, and they invited me up for lunch for dinner one night with my son, and these were people I'd, you know, gone to university. They were responsible people. Their kids were all around the same age as my son, and they lived in this row of little workers' cottages in Newtown, and there was one empty one there. They said, look, no one's taken this house because it doesn't have any windows, doesn't have any water, electricity, nothing like that. You need to put floorboards, replace things. If you want it, you know, move in. So I started to go there each day. I dropped my son off, the kids go up, and patch this place up, find bits of glass, I learned how to be a plumber in a sense, and put all these pipes in, and got it almost habitable, and to the point where I got the gas board to come out and ask them to connect it up, and they had a look at all these pipes rambling through the place and said, we'll get back to you on this, and they didn't. But I had a friend who was a plumber actually tap into the pipes so I had free gas for about 4 or 5 years, which is what you did.
How did the backyard situation work with these communal houses?
There were no fences, and all the kids would just run in and out of everyone's house, and they had a great old time.
That can work brilliantly if you've got the right people in that space. It can be fantastic for kids having a gigantic shared background, can't it?
It was terrific. Yeah, it was fantastic because they'd build, you know, they could just do whatever they like, you know, and these kids would make cubby houses and all. And they were, at the time, they were good people, you know. A lot of those squats were pretty, pretty terrible places, but I got lucky with that row.
So that's when you started thinking more about your sister and Louise, and you thought you should go looking for her. How did you set out to look for her?
Well, my life circumstances changed because my son went back with his mother, and I suddenly had more time on my hand, and I started going to art school. And in that time, I became aware that I'd probably have to. I was going to move. Actually, I was seriously thinking of moving to Victoria, and I wanted to track down my sister. And it was still a subject that my mother felt very uneasy about. But somehow I found that she was in Stockton Hospital up north of Newcastle. So I just decided to go up there one day. I got the train up there and got the ferry across to Stockton. And I found out the ward that she was in, and I went up there, and they just finished lunch, and the charge nurse at the time, I was very fortunate actually, because he called me in to his office and he said, look, don't be hard on your parents about, you know, seeing Anne Louise. She's very loved here, and she's got a good life. So don't judge them. This is what people did back in those days. It was very kind of him to say that, because that you know, I was able to sort of let go of any ill feelings towards my parents
and just focus on her.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was she like when you saw her after all these years?
She was small. She was busy. She was talkative, but it was very hard to understand what she was saying. She spoke this kind of gibberish, really, which could have been because she hadn't, well, could have been for a lot of reasons, I don't know. But
was she happy and loved there?
She was. And the charge nurse says, look, take Annie out for a walk up and buy some lollies at the little cafe. She likes that. So we walked up to this cafe and everybody knew her, and we bought some lollies, and she clutched my arm. She was clinging onto my arm. And,
she was like a little kid then, was she?
She was like a little kid. She would have been in her mid to late 20s by then, but she was just like a little kid, like a 4 or 5 year old, really. She was pointing towards the river, towards Newcastle, and she was clinging to me, and she was saying, so cold, so cold. And I sensed that she knew who I was, and that she believed that I'd come to take her, to rescue her, in a sense. And she was pulling me towards the gates at the hospital. And I had this thought. I thought we could just walk out the gates, go down the hill, get on the ferry, and I could take her back to Sydney, and we could live in a little house in Newtown, and everything would be all right. I'd look after her. And I was seriously thinking that, you know, as we're getting towards the gate. And then I thought, no, that wouldn't work out. It'd just be more trauma. And I kind of steered her back. It was very difficult, because I really believed that she was waiting for me, in a sense, to come and take her home.
Oh, was it hard to leave her that day?
It was extremely hard. It was extremely hard. But I knew if I didn't, you know, I was just some guy living in a squat in Newtown, and, you know, the police would have been had to be involved, and it would have been would have made things worse, you know, and it would have been an impossible situation.
She wouldn't have known anyone in the new place you were taking to her as well.
No, but she probably would have been happy sort of washing down tables and cleaning chairs, and because she did a lot of domestic things. So as it turned out, I did move to Melbourne shortly after that, and she actually ended up in a little house up in Port Stephens with other women around her same age. So she got out of that hospital situation in her in her later years. Yep.
So, as you said, you went to art school last after
yes.
not even knowing that there was such a thing as being an artist or an art school. What happened
exactly.
there? How did you get turned into the idea that you might want to go to an art school?
Well, I was thinking, you know, what am I going to do with my life? And I had a friend who was a street artist, basically, and I thought, man, I could do watercolours and sell them on the street or something. So that was my idea, and I went to the College of Adult Education and to do a watercolour course, and they were all full up. So I did a life drawing class instead, because there was a vacancy there, and the teacher encouraged me. She said, you ought to get a folio together and apply for art school. I didn't even know about art schools. And that's what I did. And
to get that training, to know after you've been trained exactly where to put that line that you want to make, that's a nice thing.
Well, you didn't get much training, I must admit.
Really?
You didn't get any training, to be exact, actually.
Well, it was just sitting there and do something, sit in the corner paint something.
Pretty much.
But then you went to the National Art School, which was then called East Sydney Tech in Sydney.
Right.
You moved back to Sydney.
Yep.
You would have had training there, though, surely.
No. No, that was East Sydney Tech. Oh, no, that was...
Right.
But, you know, I don't want to
right,
offend
so
anyone.
Right, so it was just fun. Here's a space where you can make
Here's a space, and today, you know, I brought in a couple of lamb's heads and and that's what you're going to paint, which is right. Great. I was happy. But there was always drawing classes. We had three drawing classes a week. There was lots of life drawing, and every spare moment I'd be off doing life drawing groups in other part-time classes in the city at the old arts building in Pitt Street. So any gaps in the week, I'd be filling it in with life drawing.
Podcast. Broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
We were talking before about your sister who was born with intellectual disabilities, and you tracked her down to a place in Stockton in Newcastle. And afterwards, she lived in somewhere on the coast, north coast of New South Wales. What became of your sister?
Well, I didn't know because I moved to Melbourne in the late 80s. But during the 90s, I would come up to Sydney each year. Christmas time, I'd spend Christmas with my mother and family members. And one Christmas, it was 1997. My brother had come down from the north coast. He's lived up there somewhere. He always lived in shacks and boats and things like that. And he'd actually had this letter from New South Wales Health saying that our sister had passed away, and they didn't have my mother's address.
So it went to your brother, the notification?
So it went to my brother, yeah. They tracked my brother down and sent him this letter, and basically that Anne Louise had passed away back in earlier that year. And if we could get in touch with, there was a number there to ring. And
so who told your mum?
I did. I think there was the cause of death was basically a heart attack. So Peter said, my brother, he said, look, do you mind telling mum? And I said, sure. So
what did your mum say when you told her?
Well, my mum I sensed that she already knew.
What do you mean?
She just said something like, yeah, I sort of felt that something had happened. Like that, and that's about all she said, and that's about all my mother would say. But in saying that, I sensed that she'd already knew, because she'd always had this strong connection there. She never talked about Anne Louise, but I knew that she was always there somehow on a mind somewhere. You know, she was always in the background, and my mum had this very strong intuitive side to her, and she had this connection with people who'd passed away. She'd always had that, and it was just. You know, I think she'd already knew about Anne Louise, and it was distressing to, in a sense, I sensed that she was relieved too, because now she got affirmation that that's what had happened.
Yeah, it must have been such a burden on her mind for all her life, I suppose.
It was, and the guilt that she would have suffered because of it, and resentment towards my father for taking my mother away from what family she had up in Brisbane, and... And probably blaming him to a large degree for her disability.
You mentioned she had this kind of intuition and this way of seeing people from the past. Mm. Did that increase as she entered her final years?
Very much so, yes, because my mother developed kidney disease, and she started to have dialysis. By this time I'd moved back up to Sydney. She had home dialysis for a while, and then she had an infection. She had to go into hospital, and it nearly killed her, and she was in ICU. I remember going out to visit her one night at Nepean Hospital, where she was in ICU, and she said to me, she said, Mum and Anne Louise came to visit me today, just like that.
Her deceased mother and her deceased daughter?
Yeah, she said they were just standing at the end of the bed.
And was she troubled or happy about that?
No, I wouldn't say troubled or happy. She was just... She was calm. She just acknowledged and she saw. I think it gave her a sense that everything was going to be okay. I know she was reflecting on it because my mum wasn't one to talk a lot, so it was comforting for her, I think.
In your beautiful sketchbook you brought in today, there's a photo of her mounted in that sketchbook of her as a young woman, as looking like a debutante, I think, or something like that from the 1940s, and the word Cloudland is written above her. Is that referring to the old classic Brisbane ballroom, the Cloudland ballroom that was in Bowen Hills in Brisbane until it was torn down?
It is, yes, and that photo would have been probably from the early 50s when my mother was in her late teens, I suppose. And I didn't know Cloudland, but I used to ask Mum about it. And she said, oh, it was, you know, such a wonderful place. And she used to go there dancing and with all the lights of Brisbane below. And
it was the most beautiful ballroom in Australia by common consensus.
Yeah.
And it was torn down by property developers.
That's right.
And it's still missed and people still talk about it in Brisbane
today. And Mum would say, you know, it had a sprung floor. You know, the Americans, when they were there during the war, gifted a sprung floor for the ballroom when they left, you know, so they could dance across it. And she remembered the bands, the music, Bill O'Smith's band, and, yeah, she would talk about it fondly. And when she passed away at a funeral, I thought, that's the woman that we want to remember, you know, this sparkling, effervescent, beautiful woman in those beautiful times, you know.
In that book, you've written a poem about your mum that she read at her eulogy. Could you read it for me, please?
Yes, thank you, Richard. I'm glad to. You're dancing now across the sprung wooden floor of the ballroom at Cloudland, the river snaking lazily below, and the lights from the city out to Wynnum flicker through the gums and poinciennas. On this hot summer night, the eyes of the suitors follow your graceful form, all satin and gardenias, to the rhythms of Bill O'Smith's band, while lightning prowls around outside, and the air electric from an approaching storm. Below, the full moon perfume of frangipani wafts up from Wickham Terrace, and we, down here, look up at the stars, the flickering lights of Cloudland.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Have you been able to support yourself over the years as an artist? What kind of odd jobs have you done over the years?
Well, for many years I taught, actually. I fell into teaching by accident, in a sense, in 1990, actually, when I first came back from overseas and I had my first exhibition. I came back to Melbourne and I was offered a drawing class in the local TAFE college, and from there I got more drawing classes and I became a teacher for probably about 12 years. So part-time teacher, exhibiting and working as a taxi driver just to keep going.
Having off and on employment, what's that meant for your living arrangements over the years?
Well, it's been difficult. I've still, for many years, I had a lot of uncertainty in my life because I accepted that. That's the artist's life, or this artist's life anyway. And I've made do as I've gone along.
Well, that's the original definition of a bohemian, the proper definition of a bohemian is someone who lives like that.
In a sense, but I didn't drink, you know. I didn't drink, I didn't party, I didn't...
You weren't taking opium?
Right. I wasn't doing any of that stuff.
Not doing absinthe or laudanum or anything like that?
Nothing like that. No. Strong cups of tea was about as far as it goes.
Yeah. And a sketchbook.
And a sketchbook, yeah. And not much room for anything else, you know, women or whatever.
What happens when you don't make art, when you're unable to make art?
I start to brood, I get anxious, I become irritable. I don't get myself into that situation. I've always got something on the go, even if it's just a drawing, even if it's just a sketch and thinking of a possibility and something to come in the future. So it's just something I do.
So if the sketchbook's been kind of necessary when you haven't had a studio?
Very much in the periods, like especially in the period when I came back from Melbourne in the early 2000s and I had a lot of uncertainty and upheaval in my life. I'd be drawing all the time because I couldn't paint and I couldn't work. So, and that's what I do when later on I was able to travel a little bit. I just keep that same work ethic happening in my sketchbooks, really.
Is it a compulsive thing? And I'm saying this because I remember like the great American underground comic artist Robert Crumb put out a book once called Waiting for Food. And it was a book of sketches he'd made on napkins over 30, 40 years or something while waiting for food. It's something that he can't stop doing. Are you like that?
Yes, I am, but I'm probably more self-conscious than someone like Robert Crumb because I antagonise over it and then the tension gets so bad I just got to pull my sketchbook out and start sketching anyway.
Given that you were sort of in and out of accommodation at times and homeless at times, did that mean you were worried about those sketchbooks? And what would become of them?
Well, I'd always have somewhere to store them. You know, they'd be stored in garages, in suitcases. I left a lot of them in the garage in Melbourne in the period when I was had a lot of intermittent accommodation in or no accommodation in Sydney. So I did. I always fretted and worried about them. You know, bushfires had hit Melbourne. I'd think, oh, you know, there goes my sketchbooks. But they were safe. And eventually, when I did get public housing here in Sydney, I was able to go back to Melbourne. And the first thing I did was, you know, bring the sketchbooks back, and they were okay. But I worried about them. You know, we had all this weather here, this wet weather, humidity, and I started to find bits of mould. So that's largely when I approached the library at the instigation of my art dealer, Frances Keevil. She suggested I write to the State Library that they may be interested in taking some. And that's what I did, and that's how it happened.
Have you gone back to them over the years to look at them and just wonder at them and wonder about the person that was that made those sketches way back when you were starting?
Yes, I was always going over them and reading them and remembering things, really, committing things to memory. And when the State Library did say they were going to acquire them, I went back over them with a finer eye, checking to see there was, you know, but make sure that there's haven't said something nasty to, or whatever. But I went over them and I looked at how they'd changed, how they'd developed, what I use them for, really.
You mentioned you got back in touch with your dad after being, I don't know, estranged. Is that a too strong a word? Well, just not being in touch with him? Estranged from him for many, many years. Where was he when you got in touch with him?
Well, we had been estranged. That was the nature of our relationship for decades, really, with my brother even more so. But when my father and I would meet up, because he was always moving around, I think the last time we met up was in Melbourne, and I'd recently moved there, and we'd had an argument or something on a railway station, and that was it. We both stormed off, and we didn't speak together for years. But it was a friend of his who I didn't even know that I came into contact with in Melbourne, who knew my father in the early 60s in Brisbane. She talked a bit about my father and she said, look, you know, your father went through a terrible time about Anne Louise, you know, my sister. That really affected him. And I didn't understand that. And she said, look, could you find out where your father's living? Because I'd like to get in touch with him. I'd like to write to him. So I did somehow through my sister, I think, and my other sister, and I found out that he was living in Ireland at the time because he'd moved over to Europe with his second wife and they lived in Greece and former Yugoslavia and that ended up in Ireland. So
he'd found that more adventurous roaming life that he'd always wanted before he became a family man.
He did, yes, he did. Later in life he went off to Europe and he loved Greece. He loved everything about, you know, Greek culture and he went there with his second wife, which is still a successful marriage And they lived in all these different places in Europe before finally settling in Ireland.
And have you been to see him there?
I have, yes, three times actually. I went, first of all, I went in the late 90s when I was still teaching. I got some long service leave. I went over there. He was living in just out of Dublin. And that was a disaster, actually, because we ended up arguing again and we were estranged for a few more years.
But and it sounds like you're so alike, though, to me, in just from what you're telling me.
In many ways we are, but intellectually, we are in a way, but emotionally, he's more like my brother. And I would say to my brother, you know, when he'd lose his temper, I think you're just like Dad, which was the worst thing you could say to him. But we are alike. But you know, we've got that we had that sort of fiery temper. But when I last saw him a couple of years back, all that had gone, you know, and we gave each other a hug, and we used to write a lot, and we found that we got on better.
On the page,
yeah. And I would get these, you know, 24-page letters from the father regularly. You know, I lived in Melbourne. They were great, actually, fantastic. And he'd send books. I'd get packages with all these wonderful books of authors that I'd never heard of. And I remember saying to him once, I said, thanks, Dad, for giving me this love of books. You know, I was able to do that, you know, and that meant a lot to him because, you know, they were my strongest memories as a kid with my father were haunting libraries and getting books out, you know.
So in 2013, you went to Italy?
Yes.
Just for the first time?
It was Italy for the first time because I've been to Europe a couple of times before, but I thought when I go to Italy, I'm just going to Italy. however long that takes, that's what I'm going to do.
Because you're a student of the great Italian painters.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't tell you the effect it had on me to see those paintings in the flesh.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it had that same effect on you to see that those works of art that you've seen only reproduced in books.
Very much so, very
on the
much.
Screen, to yes. see them on the walls themselves. Yes. What was that like for you?
It was fantastic. I'd first had contact with paintings like that when I moved to Melbourne, actually, with the few paintings that they had there of old masters and the artists from the Renaissance and the Baroque. So going over there to see them was fantastic experience, and I'd make the most of it. You know, I'd spend my days in galleries there sketching, drawing from paintings directly with pencils and taking notes, because I knew I may not get back there again, so I used it as a school, really.
Now that the State Library in New South Wales has these 65 sketchbooks and they can be seen on display from time to time, is that a bit weird? Do you feel people are like traipsing through your inner life and not, your backyard? And
not really. It doesn't bother me now because for years I would, you know, I would take those sketchbooks in to show students when I was teaching to encourage them to draw, to use a sketchbook. You know, my private life, so to speak, was kind of public anyway. So there's so many of these sketchbooks that I've been keeping that it's I'm happy that they're just gone to somewhere safe. And the ones to come, or the ones that I've still got at home that I'm still working through, in a sense, thinking there may still be paintings I want to do out of those sketches, that they'll end up there in that State Library. And for me, it's a wonderful thing that it's a wonderful thing to be appreciated, you know, and all that. All those years of what I've been doing, doodling around in sketchbooks, whatever, that they're going to live on beyond me. So it's a great feeling, actually. I feel very privileged that whatever else happens, that will live on, and that, you know, the people in my life, you know, my family, that their stories will be their stories are there too. You know, the story of my older sister Anne Louise, my brother, my mother, people I've known in places around Sydney, you know, Rough Edges and soup kitchens, and people who've passed on also, you know, all sorts of people. But they're alive there on the page in those sketchbooks, and that's very satisfying, yes.
Michael, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard, for inviting me in. It's been wonderful.
Michael Kelly's having a small retrospective exhibition of his work at Studio W in Woolloomooloo in Sydney in August this year. Today's conversation was made in Gadigal, Turrbal and Jagera lands and was produced by Alice Moldovan, and our EP is Carmel Rooney. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.